uneducated woman, married at 13, had been smart enough to figure out things for herself and to emphasize to Curtis and me that people are people. She never gave vent to racial prejudice and wouldn't let us do it either. Curtis and I encountered prejudice, and we could have gotten caught up in it, especially in those days, the early 1960s. Three incidents of racial prejudice directed against us stand out in my memory. First, when I started going to Wilson Junior High, Curtis and I often hopped a train to get to school. We had fun doing that because the tracks ran parallel to our school route. While we knew we weren't supposed to hop trains, I placated my conscience by deciding to get on only the slower trains. My brother would grab onto the fast-moving trains which had to slow down at the crossing. I envied Curtis as I watched him in action. When the faster trains came through, just past the crossing, he would throw his clarinet on one of the flat cars near the front of the train. Then he'd wait and catch the last flat car. If he didn't get on and make his way to the front, he knew he'd lose his clarinet. Curtis never lost his musical instrument. We chose a dangerous adventure, and every time we jumped on a train, my body tingled with excitement. We not only had to jump and catch a car railing and hold on, but we had to make sure the railroad security men never caught us. They watched for kids and hobos who hopped the trains at crossroads. They never did catch us. We stopped hopping trains for an entirely different reason. One day, when Curtis wasn't with me, as I ran along the tracks, a group of older boys, all white, came marching toward me, anger written on their faces. One of them carried a big stick. "Hey, you, nigger boy." I stopped and stared, frightened and silent. I've always been extremely thin and must have looked terribly defenseless, and I was. The boy with the stick whacked me across the shoulder. I recoiled, not sure what would happen next. He and the other boys stood in front of me and called me every dirty name they could think of. My heart pounded in my ears, and sweat poured down my sides. I looked down at my feet, too scared to answer, too frightened to run. "You know you nigger kids ain't supposed to be going to Wilson Junior High. If we ever catch you again, we're gonna kill you." His pale eyes were cold as death. "You understand that?" My gaze never left the ground. "Guess so," I muttered. "I said, do you understand me, nigger boy?" the big boy prodded. Fear choked me. I tried to speak louder. "Yes? Then you get out of here as fast as you can run, and you better be keeping an eye out for us. Next time, we're gonna kill you." I ran then, as fast as I could, and didn't slow down until I reached the schoolyard. I stopped using that route and went another way. From then on, I never hopped another train, and I never saw the gang again. Certain that my mother would have yanked us out of school right away, I never told her about the incident. A second, more shocking episode occurred when I was in the 8th grade. At the end of each school year, the principal and teachers handed out certificates to the one student who had the highest academic achievement in the 7th, 8th, and 9th grades, respectively. I won the certificate in the 7th grade, and that same year, Curtis won for the 9th grade. By the end of 8th grade, people had pretty much come to accept the fact that I was a smart kid. I won the certificate again the following year. At the all-school assembly, one of the teachers presented my certificate. After handing it to me, she remained up in front of the entire student body and looked out across the auditorium. "I have a few words I want to say right now," she began, her voice unusually high. Then, to my embarrassment, she bawled out the white kids because they had allowed me to be number one. "You're not trying hard enough," she told them. While she never quite said it in words, she let them know that a black person shouldn't be number one in a class where everyone else was white. As the teacher continued to berate the other students, a number of things tumbled about inside my mind. Of course I was hurt. I had worked hard to be the top of my class, probably harder than anyone else in the school, and she was putting me down because I wasn't the same color. On the one hand, I thought, what a turkey this woman is. Then an angry determination welled up inside. I'll show you and all the others, too. I couldn't understand why this woman talked the way she did. She had taught me herself in several classes, had seemed to like me, and she clearly knew that I had earned my grades and merited the certificate of achievement. Why would she say all those harsh things? Was she so ignorant that she didn't realize that people are just people? That their skin or their race doesn't make them smarter or dumber? It also occurred to me that, given enough situations, there are bound to be instances where minorities are smarter. Couldn't she realize that? Despite my hurt and anger, I didn't say anything. I sat quietly while she railed. Several of the white kids glanced over at me occasionally, rolling their eyes to let me understand their disgust. I sensed they were trying to say to me, "What a dummy she is." Some of those very kids who, 3 years earlier, had taunted me, had become my friends. They were feeling embarrassed, and I could read resentment on several faces. I didn't tell Mother about that teacher. I didn't think it would do any good and would only hurt her feelings. The third incident that stands out in my memory centered around the football team. In our neighborhood, we had a football league. When I was in the seventh grade, playing football was the big thing in athletics. Naturally, both Curtis and I wanted to play. Neither of us Carsons were large to begin with. In fact, compared to the other players, we were quite small. But we had one advantage. We were fast. So fast that we could outrun everybody else on the field. Because the Carson brothers made such good showings, our performance apparently upset a few of the white people. One afternoon, when Curtis and I left the field after practice, a group of white men, none of them over 30 years old, surrounded us. Their menacing anger showed clearly before they said a word. I wasn't sure if they were part of the gang that had threatened me at the railroad crossing. I only knew I was scared. Then one man stepped forward. "If you guys come back, we're going to throw you into the river," he said. Then they turned and walked away from us. Would they have carried out their threat? Curtis and I weren't as concerned about that as we were with the fact that they didn't want us in the league. As we walked home, I said to my brother, "Who wants to play football when your own supporters are against you?" "I think we can find better things to do with our time," Curtis said. We never said anything to anyone about quitting, but we never went back to practice. Nobody in the neighborhood ever asked us why. To Mother, I said, "We decided not to play football." Curtis said something about studying more. We had decided to say nothing to Mother about the threat, knowing that if we did, she'd be worried sick about us. As an adult, looking backward, it's ironic about our family. When we were younger, through her silence, Mother had protected us from the truth about Dad and her emotional problems. Now it was our turn to protect her so she wouldn't worry. We chose the same method. Chapter 5. A Boy's Big Problem. "Know what the Indians did with General Custer's worn-out clothes?" the gang leader asked. "Tell us," one of his cohorts shot back with exaggerated interest. "They saved them, and now our man Carson wears them." Another kid nodded vigorously. "Sure looks it." I could feel the heat rising up my neck and cheeks. The guys were at it again. "Get close enough and you'll believe it," the first fellow laughed, "'cause they smell like they're 100 years old." New in the grade of 8A at Hunter Junior High, I found capping an embarrassing and painful experience. The term comes from the word capitalize and is slang that means to get the better of another person. The idea was to make the most sarcastic remark possible, throwing in a quick barb to keep it humorous. Capping was always done within earshot of the victim, and the best targets were the kids whose clothes were a little out of style. The best cappers waited until a group collected around the violator. Then they'd compete to see who could say the funniest and most insulting things. I was a special target. For one thing, clothes hadn't meant much to me then, and they don't today. Except for a brief period in my life, I've not been much concerned about what I wore, because like Mother always said, "Benny, what's inside counts the most. Anybody can dress up on the outside and be dead inside." I hated leaving Wilson Junior High at the middle of the eighth grade, but was excited to be moving back to our old house. As I said to myself, "We're going home again." That was the most important thing of all. Because of my mother's frugality, our financial situation had gradually improved. Mother was finally able to get enough money, and we moved back to the house where we lived before my parents divorced. Despite the smallness of the house, it was home. Today, I see it more realistically, more like a matchbox. But to the three of us then, the house seemed like a mansion, a really fabulous place. But moving home meant the need to change schools. While Curtis went on to Southwestern High School, I enrolled in Hunter Junior High, a predominantly black school with about 30% of the students white. Classmates immediately recognized me as a smart kid. Although I wasn't quite at the top, only one or two others passed me in grades. I'd grown used to academic success, enjoyed it, and decided to stay on top. At that point, however, I felt a new pressure, one that I hadn't been subjected to before. Besides the capping, I faced the constant temptation to become one of the guys. I'd never had to be involved in this kind of thing before in order to be accepted. In the other schools, kids looked up to me because of my top grades. But at Hunter Junior High, academics came a little farther down the line. Being accepted by the in-group meant wearing the right clothes, going to the places where the guys hung out, and playing basketball. Even more important, to be part of the in-group, kids had to learn to cap on others. I couldn't ask my mother to buy me the kind of clothes that would put me on their social acceptance level. While I may not have understood how hard my mother worked, I knew she was trying to keep us off of public assistance. By the time I went into ninth grade, Mother had made such strides that she received nothing except food stamps. She couldn't have provided for us and kept up the house without that subsidy. Because she wanted to do the best she could for Curtis and me, she skimped on herself. Her clothes were clean and respectable, but they weren't stylish. Of course, being a kid, I never noticed, and she never complained. For the first few weeks, I didn't say anything when the guys capped on me. My lack of response only encouraged them to bear down, and they capped on me mercilessly. I felt horrible, left out, and hurt because I didn't fit in. Walking home alone, I'd wonder, what's wrong with me? Why can't I belong? Why do I have to be different? I comforted myself by saying, they're just a bunch of buffoons. If this is how they get their enjoyment, they can go ahead, but I'm not going to play their silly game. I'm going to be successful, and one day I'll show all of them. Despite my defensive words, I still felt left out and rejected. And like most people, I wanted to belong and didn't like being an outsider. Unfortunately, after a while, their attitude rubbed off on me until eventually the disease infected me too. Then I said to myself, "All right, if you guys want a cap, I'll show you how to cap." The next day, I waited for the capping to start. And it did. A ninth grader said, "Man, that shirt you're wearing has been through World War I, World War II, World War III, and World War IV. "Yeah," I said. "And your mama wore it." Everybody laughed. He stared at me, hardly believing what I'd said. Then he started to laugh, too. He slapped me on the back. "Hey, man, that's okay." My esteem rose right then. Soon I capped on the top cappers throughout the whole school. It felt great to be recognized for my sharp tongue. From then on, when anyone capped on me, I'd turn it around and fling it into their faces, which was the idea of the game. Within weeks, the in-crowd stopped tormenting me. They didn't dare direct any sarcasm my way because they knew I would come up with something better. Once in a while, students ducked out of the way when they saw me coming. I didn't let them get away even then. "Hey, Miller, I'd hide my face too if I looked that ugly." A mean remark? Certainly. But I comforted myself by saying, everybody does it. Outcapping everyone else is the only way to survive. Or sometimes I'd say, he knows I didn't really mean it. It didn't take long for me to forget how it felt to be the object of capping. My taking over the game solved one great problem for me. Unfortunately, it didn't solve what to do about clothes. Aside from being ostracized for my clothes, the kids called me poor a lot. And to their thinking, if you were poor, you were no good. Oddly enough, none of the students were well off and had no right to talk about anybody else. But as a young teenager, I didn't reason that out. I felt the stigma of being poor most acutely because I didn't have a father. Most of the kids I knew had two parents, and that convinced me that they were better off. During ninth grade, one task brought more embarrassment to me than anything else. As I've said, we received food stamps and couldn't have made it without them. Occasionally, my mother sent me to the store to buy bread or milk with the stamps. I hated to go, fearing one of my friends would see what I was doing. If anyone I knew came up to the checkout counter, I'd pretend that I had forgotten something and duck down one of the aisles until he left. Waiting until nobody else stood in line, I'd rush forward with the items I had to buy. I could accept being poor, but I died 1,000 deaths thinking that other kids would know it. If I had thought more logically about the food stamps, I would have realized that quite a few of my friends' families used them too. Yet every time I left the house with the stamps burning in my pocket, I worried that someone might see me or hear about using food stamps and then talk about me. So far as I know, no one ever did. The ninth grade stands out as a pivotal time in my life. As an A student, I could stand up intellectually with the best, and I could hold my own with the best, or worst, of my classmates. It was a time of transition. I was leaving childhood and beginning to think seriously about the future, and especially about my desire to be a doctor. By the time I hit the 10th grade, however, the peer pressure had gotten to be too much for me. Clothes were my biggest problem. "I can't wear these pants," I'd tell Mother. "Everyone will laugh at me." "Only stupid people laugh at what you wear, Benny," she'd say. Or, "It's not what you're wearing that makes the difference." "But Mother," I'd plead, "everybody I know has better clothes than I do." "Maybe so," she'd patiently tell me. "I know a lot of people who dress better than I do, but that doesn't make them better." Just about every day, I begged and pressured my mother, insisting that I had to have the right kind of clothes. I knew exactly what I meant by the right kind. Italian knit shirts with suede fronts, silk pants, thick and thin silk socks, alligator shoes, stingy brim hats, leather jackets, and suede coats. I talked about those clothes constantly, and it seemed like I couldn't think about anything else. I had to have those clothes. I had to be like the in crowd. Mother was disappointed in me, and I knew it, but all I could think of was my poor wardrobe and my need for acceptance. Instead of coming directly home after school and doing my homework, I played basketball. Sometimes I stayed out until 10 o'clock and a few times until 11. When I came home, I knew what to expect, and I prepared myself to endure it. "Benny, can't you see what you're doing to yourself? It's more than just disappointing me. You're going to ruin your life staying out all hours and begging for nothing but fine clothes." "I'm not ruining my life," I insisted, because I didn't want to listen. I couldn't have heard anything because my immature mind focused on being like everybody else. "I've been proud of you, Benny," she would say. "You've worked hard. Don't lose all of that now." "I'll keep doing all right," I'd snap back. "I'll be okay. Haven't I been bringing home good grades?" She couldn't argue with me on that issue, but I knew she worried. "All right, son," she finally told me. Then, after weeks of my pleading for new clothes, Mother said the words I wanted to hear. "I'll try to get some of those fancy clothes for you, if that's what it takes to make you happy. You'll have them." "They'll make me happy," I said. "They will." It's hard for me to believe how insensitive I was back then. Without thinking about her needs, I let Mother go without to buy me clothes that would help me dress like the in crowd. But I never had enough. Now I realize that no matter how many Italian shirts, leather jackets, or alligator shoes she bought, they would never have been enough. My grades dropped. I went from the top of the class to being a C student. Even worse, achieving only average grades didn't bother me because I was part of the in group. I hung out with the popular guys. They invited me to their parties and jam sessions. And fun! I was having more fun than I'd ever had in my life because I was one of the guys. I just wasn't very happy. I had strayed from the important and basic values in my life. To explain that statement, I have to go back to my mother again and tell you about a visit from Mary Thomas. When my mother was in the hospital to deliver me, she had her first contact with Seventh-day Adventists. Mary Thomas was visiting in the hospital and started talking to her about Jesus Christ. Mother listened politely but had little interest in what she had to say. Later, as I've already mentioned, Mother was so emotionally hurt that she checked herself into a mental hospital. At one point, she seriously considered committing suicide by saving up her daily medication and taking all the pills at once. Then one afternoon, a woman visited my mother in the hospital. She had met the woman once before, Mary Thomas. This quiet but zealous woman began talking to her about God. That in itself was nothing new. From the time she was a little girl in Tennessee, Mother had heard about God. Yet Mary Thomas approached religion differently. She didn't try to force anything on Mother or tell her how sinful she was. Instead, Mary Thomas simply expressed her own beliefs and paused occasionally to read verses from the Bible that explained the basis for her faith. More important than her teaching, Mary genuinely cared about Mother. And right then, Mother needed someone to care. Even before the divorce, Mother was a desperate woman with two young kids and no idea how to take care of them if things didn't work out. She was ostracized by many who felt she was unconventional. Then along came Mary Thomas with what seemed like a single ray of hope. "There is another source of strength, Sonia," the visitor said. "And this strength can be yours." Those were exactly the words she needed as a stabilizing force in her life. Mother finally understood that she wasn't all alone in the world. Over a period of weeks, Mary went over the teachings of her church, and Mother slowly came to believe in a loving God who expresses that love through Jesus Christ. Day after day, Mary Thomas talked patiently with Mother, answering questions and listening to anything she wanted to say. Mother's third-grade education prevented her from reading most of the Bible passages, but her visitor didn't give up. She stayed at it, reading everything aloud, and through that woman's influence, my mother began to study and read for herself. Even though Mother could barely read, once she decided to learn, through hours of practice, she taught herself to read well. Mother started to read the Bible, often sounding out the words, sometimes still not understanding, but she persisted. That was her determination at work. Eventually, she was able to read relatively sophisticated material. Aunt Jean and Uncle William, with whom we stayed after my parents' divorce, had become Adventists in Boston. With their encouragement, it wasn't long until Mother grew stronger in her beliefs. Never one to go into anything half-heartedly, she immediately became active and has remained a devout church member. And from the time of her own conversion, she started taking Curtis and me to church with her. The Adventist denomination is the only spiritual home I've ever known. When I was 12 and more mature, I realized that although I'd been emotionally touched at age 8 and even had been baptized, I hadn't understood exactly what being a Christian meant. By the time I was 12, we had moved and were attending the Sharon Seventh-day Adventist Church in Inkster. After days of thinking about the matter, I spoke with Pastor Smith. "Although I've been baptized," I said, "I didn't really grasp the significance of what I was doing." "You do understand now?" "Oh yes, I'm 12 now," I said, "and I believe in Jesus Christ. After all, Jesus was 12 when his parents first took him to the temple in Jerusalem, so I'd like to be baptized again, because I understand and I'm ready now." Pastor Smith listened sympathetically, and having no problem with my request, he rebaptized me. Yet in looking back, I'm not sure when I actually turned to God. Or perhaps it happened so gradually that I had no awareness of the progression. I do know that when I was 14, I finally understood how God can change us. It was at age 14 that I confronted the most severe personal problem of my life, one that almost ruined me forever. Chapter 6. A Terrible Temper. "That sure was a dumb thing to say," Jerry taunted as we walked down the hall together after English class. Kids crowded us on all sides, and Jerry's voice rose above the din. I shrugged. Guess so. My wrong answer in seventh grade English had been embarrassing enough. I didn't want to be reminded.
You guess?
Jerry's laugh was shrill.
Listen, Carson, that was one of the all-time stupid things of the year.
I turned my eyes toward him. He was taller and heavier, not even one of my close friends.
You said some pretty dumb things, too, I said softly.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just last week you...
Our words flew back and forth, my voice remaining calm, while his grew louder and louder. Finally, I turned to my locker. I'd just ignore him, and maybe he'd shut up and go away. My fingers twirled the combination lock. Then, just as I lifted the lock, Jerry shoved me. I stumbled, and my temper flared. I forgot the 20 pounds of muscle he had on me. I didn't see the kids and teachers milling in the hall. I swung at him, lock in hand. The blow slammed into his forehead, and he groaned, staggering backward, blood seeping from a 3-inch gash. Dazed, Jerry slowly lifted his hand to his forehead. He felt the sticky blood and carefully lowered his hand in front of his eyes. He screamed. Of course the principal called me in. I'd calmed down by then and apologized profusely.
It was almost an accident, I told him.
I never would have hit him if I'd remembered the lock in my hand. I meant it, too. I was ashamed. Christians don't lose their temper like that. I apologized to Jerry, and the incident was closed. And my temper? I forgot about it. I wasn't the kind of guy who'd split open a kid's head on purpose. Some weeks later, Mother brought home a new pair of pants for me. I took one look at them and shook my head.
No way, Mother, I'm not going to wear them. They're the wrong kind.
What do you mean, wrong kind? She countered. She was tired, her voice firm.
You need new pants. Now just wear these.
I flung them back at her.
No,
I yelled.
I'm not going to wear these ugly things.
She folded the pants across the back of the plastic kitchen chair.
I can't take them back.
Her voice was patient. They were on special.
I don't care.
I spun to face her.
I hate them, and I wouldn't be caught dead in them.
I paid good money for these pants. They're not what I want. She took a step forward.
Listen, Benny, we don't always get what we want out of life.
Heat poured through my body, inflaming my face, energizing my muscles.
I will, I yelled. Just wait and see. I will. I'll...
My right arm drew back. My hand swung forward. Curtis jumped me from behind, wrestling me away from Mother, pinning my arms to my side. The fact that I almost hit my mother should have made me realize how deadly my temper had become. Maybe I knew it, but wouldn't admit the truth to myself. I had what I only can label a pathological temper, a disease. And this sickness controlled me, making me totally irrational. In general, I was a good kid. It usually took a lot to make me mad, but once I reached the boiling point, I lost all rational control. Totally without thinking, when my anger was aroused, I grabbed the nearest brick, rock, or stick to bash someone. It was as if I had no conscious will in the matter. Friends who didn't know me, as a kid, think I'm exaggerating when I say I had a bad temper. But it's no exaggeration, and to make it clear, here are just two more of my crazed experiences. I can't remember how this one started, but a neighborhood kid hit me with a rock. It didn't hurt, but again, out of that insane kind of anger, I raced to the side of the road, picked up a big rock, and hurled it at his face. I seldom missed when I threw anything. The rock broke his glasses and smashed his nose. I was in the 9th grade when the unthinkable happened. I lost control and tried to knife a friend. Bob and I were listening to a transistor radio when he flipped the dial to another station.
"You call that music?"
he demanded.
"It's better than what you like," I yelled back, grabbing for the dial.
"Come on, Carson, you always—" In that instant, blind anger, pathological anger, took possession of me. Grabbing the camping knife I carried in my back pocket, I snapped it open and lunged for the boy who had been my friend. With all the power of my young muscles, I thrust the knife toward his belly. The knife hit his big, heavy, ROTC buckle with such force that the blade snapped and dropped to the ground. I stared at the broken blade and went weak. I had almost killed him. I had almost killed my friend. If the buckle hadn't protected him, Bob would have been lying at my feet, dying or severely wounded. He didn't say anything, just looked at me, unbelieving. I'm sorry, I muttered, dropping the handle. I couldn't look him in the eye. Without a word, I turned and ran home. Thankfully, the house was empty, for I couldn't bear to see anyone. I raced to the bathroom where I could be alone and locked the door. Then I sank down on the edge of the tub, my long legs stretching across the linoleum, bumping against the sink. I tried to kill Bob. I tried to kill my friend. No matter how tightly I squeezed my eyes shut, I couldn't escape the image. My hand, my knife, the belt buckle, the broken knife, and Bob's face. This is crazy, I finally mumbled. I must be crazy. Sane people don't try to kill their friends. The rim of the tub felt cool under my hands. I put my hands on my hot face. I'm doing so well at school, and then I do this? I dreamed of being a doctor since I was 8 years old, but how could I fulfill the dream with such a terrible temper? When angry, I went out of control and had no idea how to stop. I'd never make anything of myself if I didn't control my temper. If only I could do something about the rage that burned inside me. 2 hours passed. The green and brown, squiggly, snake-like design on the linoleum swam before my eyes. I felt sick to my stomach, disgusted with myself, and ashamed. Unless I get rid of this temper, I said aloud, I'm not going to make it. If Bob hadn't worn that big buckle, he'd probably be dead, and I'd be on my way to jail or reform school. Misery washed over me. My sweaty shirt stuck to my back. Sweat trickled down my armpits and my sides. I hated myself, but I couldn't help myself, and so I hated myself even more. From somewhere deep inside my mind came a strong impression. Pray. My mother had taught me to pray. My teachers at the religious school in Boston often told us that God would help us if we only asked Him. For weeks, for months, I'd been trying to control my temper, figuring I could handle it myself. Now, in that small, hot bathroom, I knew the truth. I could not handle my temper alone. I felt as though I could never face anyone again. How could I look my mother in the eye? Would she know? How could I ever see Bob again? How could he help but hate me? How could he ever trust me again? Lord, I whispered, you have to take this temper from me. If you don't, I'll never be free from it. I'll end up doing things a lot worse than trying to stab one of my best friends. Already heavy into psychology, I had been reading Psychology Today for a year, I knew that temper was a personality trait. Standard thinking in the field pointed out the difficulty, if not the impossibility, of modifying personality traits. Even today, some experts believe that the best we can do is accept our limitations and adjust to them. Tears streamed between my fingers. Lord, despite what all the experts tell me, you can change me. You can free me forever from this destructive personality trait. I wiped my nose on a piece of toilet paper and let it drop to the floor. You've promised that if we come to you and ask something in faith, that you'll do it. I believe that you can change this in me. I stood up, looking at the narrow window, still pleading for God's help. I couldn't go on hating myself forever for all the terrible things I'd done. I sank down on the toilet, sharp mental pictures of other temper fits filling my mind. I saw my anger, clenched my fists against my rage. I wouldn't be any good for anything if I couldn't change. My poor mother, I thought. She believes in me. Not even she knows how bad I am. Misery engulfed me in darkness. If you don't do this for me, God, I've got no place else to go. At one point, I'd slipped out of the bathroom long enough to grab a Bible. Now I opened it and began to read in Proverbs. Immediately I saw a string of verses about angry people and how they get themselves into trouble. Proverbs 16:32 impressed me the most. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. My lips moved wordlessly as I continued to read. I felt as though the verses had been written just to me, for me. The words of Proverbs condemned me, but they also gave me hope. After a while, peace began to fill my mind. My hands stopped shaking, the tears stopped. During those hours alone in the bathroom, something happened to me. God heard my deep cries of anguish. A feeling of lightness flowed over me, and I knew a change of heart had taken place. I felt different. I was different. At last I stood up, placed the Bible on the edge of the tub, and went to the sink. I washed my face and hands, straightened my clothes. I walked out of the bathroom a changed young man. My temper will never control me again, I told myself. Never again. I'm free. And since that day, since those long hours wrestling with myself and crying to God for help, I have never had a problem with my temper. That same afternoon, I decided I would read the Bible every day. I've kept that practice as a daily habit, and especially enjoy the book of Proverbs. Even now, whenever possible, I pick up my Bible and read the first thing every morning. The miracle that took place was incredible when I stopped to think about it. Some of my psychologically oriented friends insist that I still have the potential for anger. Maybe they're right. But I've lived more than 40 years since that experience, and I've never had another flare-up or even had a serious problem of needing to control my temper. I can tolerate amazing amounts of stress and ridicule. By God's grace, it still doesn't require any effort to shake off unpleasant, irritating things. God has helped me to conquer my terrible temper once and forever. During those hours in the bathroom, I also came to realize that if people could make me angry, they could control me. Why should I give someone else such power over my life? Over the years, I've chuckled at people who deliberately did things they thought would make me angry. I'm no better than anyone else, but I laugh inside at how foolish people can be trying to make me angry. They don't have any control over me. And this is the reason. From that terrible day when I was 14 years old, my faith in God has been intensely personal and an important part of who I am. About that time, I started to hum or sing a hymn that has continued to be my favorite. Jesus is all the world to me. Whenever anything irritates me, that hymn dissolves my negativity. I've explained it this way to young people. I have sunshine in my heart, regardless of conditions around me. I'm not afraid of anything as long as I think of Jesus Christ and my relationship to Him and remember that the one who created the universe can do anything. I also have evidence, my own experience, that God can do anything, because He changed me. From age 14, I began to focus on the future. My mother's lessons, and those of several of my teachers, were at last paying off. Chapter 7. ROTC Triumph. I was 10 years old when I first became interested in Johns Hopkins University Hospital. Back in those days, it seemed that every television or newspaper medical story involved somebody at Johns Hopkins, so I said, that's where I want to go when I become a doctor. Those guys are finding cures and new ways to help sick people. Although I had no question about wanting to become a doctor, the particular field of medicine wasn't always so clear. For instance, when I was 13, my focus changed from being a general practitioner to becoming a psychiatrist. Watching TV programs featuring psychiatrists convinced me, for they came across as dynamic intellectuals who knew everything about solving anybody's problems. At that same age, I was very aware of money and figured that with so many crazy people living in the United States, psychiatrists must make a good living. If I had any doubts about my chosen career, they dissolved after my 13th birthday when Curtis gave me a subscription to Psychology Today. It was the perfect gift. Not only a great brother, but a good friend, Curtis must have really sacrificed to spend his hard-earned money for me. He was only 15, and his after-school job in the science lab didn't pay a lot. Curtis was generous, but also sensitive to me. Because he knew I was getting interested in psychology and psychiatry, he chose that way to help me. Though I found Psychology Today tough reading for a kid my age, I grasped enough from the different articles that I could hardly wait for each issue to arrive. I also read books in that field. For a while, I fancied myself as some sort of local shrink. Other kids came to me with their problems. I was a good listener, and I learned certain techniques for helping others. I'd ask questions like, "Do you want to talk about it?" Or, "What's troubling you today?" The kids opened up. Maybe they just wanted a chance to talk about their problems. Some of them were willing to listen. I felt honored to have their confidence and to know that they were willing to tell me their troubles. "Well, Benjamin," I said to myself one day, "you've found your chosen field, and you're already moving into it." Not until my days in medical school would that focus shift once more. In the second half of 10th grade, I joined the ROTC. I'll confess that I did that largely because of Curtis. I really admired my brother, although I would never have told him so. Whether he knew it or not, he provided a role model for me. He was one of the people I wanted to emulate. It made me proud to see him in his uniform, his chest plastered with more medals and ribbons than anybody I knew. My joining the ROTC started another change in my life, helping me to get back on the right track. My brother, then a senior, had reached the rank of captain and was the company commander when I became a private. Curtis never got caught up in the peer thing and the demand for clothes like I did. He stayed on the honor roll and remained a good student right through high school. He graduated near the top of his class and went on to the University of Michigan, eventually majoring in engineering. Curtis graduated from high school at the height of the war in Vietnam. In those days, the Selective Service used a lottery system to determine who should go into the military service. Curtis's low lottery number assured him that if he waited, the Army would draft him. After completing a year and a half of college, he decided to join the Navy. "I may as well get the branch of service that I want," he said. He got into a special program, and the Navy trained him to be a nuclear submarine operator. It was a 6-year program, although he did not re-enlist after his 4-year stint. He progressed quite well through the ranks and probably would have been at least a captain by now if he had stayed in. However, he decided to go back to college. Today, Curtis is an engineer, and I'm still proud of my big brother. After I joined ROTC, another significant person came into my life, a student named Sharper. He had reached the highest rank given to a student, that of a full colonel. Sharper seemed so mature, so self-assured, and yet likable. "He's incredible," I thought, as I watched him drill the entire ROTC unit. Then came the next thought. If Sharper can make colonel, why can't I? At that moment, I decided I wanted to be a student colonel. Because I joined ROTC late, in the second half of 10th grade instead of the beginning of the year like the others, it meant I'd be in ROTC only 5 semesters instead of 6. From the beginning, I realized that my chances of ever making it to the top weren't very good, but instead of discouraging me, the thought challenged me. I determined that I would go as far as I possibly could in ROTC before I graduated. My mother continued to talk to me about my attitude and began to make an impression. She didn't lecture because she was discovering more subtle ways to encourage me. She memorized poems and famous sayings and kept quoting them to me. Thinking about it now, Mother was incredible. Memorizing long poems like Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken, she often quoted to me a poem called You Have Yourself to Blame, a poem I've never been able to find in print. But it's about people offering excuses for failing to do their best. The bottom line was that we have only ourselves to blame. We create our own destiny by the way we do things. We have to take advantage of opportunities and be responsible for our choices. Mother stayed on me until I fully grasped that I am the one ultimately responsible for my life. I had to take charge if I wanted to amount to anything. Soon, my grades zoomed upward again. During both the 11th and 12th grades, I ranked among the A students again. I had gotten back on the right track. Another influential person in my life was an English teacher named Mrs. Miller. She took a personal interest in me in ninth grade English and taught me a lot of extra things after class. She was proud of me because I was such a good student, and she taught me to appreciate good literature and poetry. We'd go over everything I'd done in class that wasn't perfect, and she stayed with me until I corrected every mistake. In the 10th grade, when my grades dropped, she was disappointed. Even though I no longer had her for a teacher, she kept up with me and knew that my indifference to schoolwork caused my grades to fall because I was just hanging out instead of trying. I felt bad about that because she was so disappointed. At that point, I felt more guilty about disappointing her than I did my mother. Finally, I began to realize that I had myself, and only myself, to blame. The in-group had no power over me unless I chose to give it to them. I started pulling away from them. The clothes issue largely resolved itself because in ROTC we had to wear a uniform 3 days a week. That meant I had to wear regular clothes only 2 days a week, and I had enough of the right clothes that kids didn't talk about me. With my clothes problem solved and my changed attitude, once again I started doing very well in school. Several teachers played important roles in my life during my high school years. They gave me personal attention, encouraged me, and all of them tried to inspire me to keep trying. I particularly admired and appreciated two men teachers. First, Frank McCotter, the biology teacher. He was white, about 5'9", medium build, and wore glasses. If I'd first seen him on the street without knowing anything about him, I would have said, "That's a biology teacher." Mr. McCotter had so much confidence in my abilities that he pushed me to take more responsibility, and he provided me with extra tutoring in the biological sciences. McCotter assigned me the responsibility to design experiments for the other students, to set them up, and to keep the lab running smoothly. The second teacher, Lemuel Doakes, directed the band. He was black, well-built, and serious most of the time, although he had a fine sense of humor. Mr. Doakes always demanded perfection. He wouldn't settle for our getting the music right. We had to play it perfectly. More than being a teacher with interests limited primarily to music, Mr. Doakes encouraged my academic pursuits. He saw that I had musical talent, but he told me, "Carson, you have to put academics first. Always put first things first." I thought that was an admirable attitude for a music teacher. As much as for his music, I also admired Mr. Doakes for being courageous. He was one of the few teachers who would stand up to the bullies in the school and not let them scare him. He wouldn't tolerate any foolishness. A few students challenged him, but they ended up backing down. I earned a lot of medals in ROTC for being a member of the rifle team and drill team. I won academic awards in just about every competition offered. Along with this, I received rapid promotion. One of the big challenges came when I was a master sergeant. Sergeant Bandy, an instructor in the United States Army and head of the ROTC unit at our high school, put me in charge of the fifth-hour ROTC unit because the students were so rambunctious that none of the other student sergeants could handle them. "Carson, I'm going to put you in charge of this class," he said. "If you can make anything out of them, I'll promote you to second lieutenant." That was exactly the challenge I needed. I did two things. First, I tried to get to know the guys in the class and discover what really interested them. Then I structured the classes and the exercises accordingly. I offered extra practice on fancy drill routine at the end of each successful teaching session, and the guys loved doing that. Second, reverting to my earlier skill at capping on people paid off. They soon shaped up because when they didn't do things appropriately, they learned I could make them look bad by capping on them. This method didn't employ the best psychology, but it worked, and they fell into line. It was just before summer, and I'd been working hard with the class for several weeks, when Sergeant Bandy called me into his office. "Carson," he said, "the fifth-hour class is the best unit in the school. You have done a fine job." And true to his word, Bandy promoted me to second lieutenant at the end of the year, unheard of in our school. I made second lieutenant after only 3 semesters when it usually took at least 4, and most ROTC cadets never reached that rank in 6 semesters. The promotion allowed me to try for field grade because only after making second lieutenant could anyone sit for field grade examinations. The normal route went from second lieutenant to first lieutenant to captain and then to major. After that, few students went on to become lieutenant colonel, and only 3 in the whole city of Detroit made full colonel. Sergeant Bandy set it up for me to go up for the field grade examination. I did so well that he scheduled me to appear before a board of majors and captains in the real army. About that time, Sergeant Hunt became the first black sergeant in charge of our ROTC unit, replacing Sergeant Bandy. Sergeant Hunt recognized my leadership ability and, because I was doing so well academically, he took a special interest in me. He'd often take me aside and say things like, "Carson, I've got big plans for you." Sergeant Hunt used to give me a lot of extra hints and suggestions, sharing his own insights into things that the examiners would want me to know. "Carson," he'd bark, "you gotta learn this, and gotta learn it perfect." I memorized all of the required material. The regular army officers who conducted the examination asked every possible question from our training manuals. Questions about terrain, battle strategies, various weapons and weapon systems, and I was ready. When I went up for the field grade examination, along with representatives from each of the 22 schools in the city, I made the highest score. In fact, my total was, at least then, the highest any student had ever achieved. To my delighted surprise, I received another promotion, all the way from second lieutenant to lieutenant colonel, again a feat totally unheard of. Naturally, I was elated. Even more of a wonder, this took place during the first part of 12th grade. I could hardly believe it myself. From the second half of 10th grade, 10A, I had gone from private to lieutenant colonel by the time I reached 12B. I still had a full semester of school left, and another field grade examination was coming up. That meant I actually had an opportunity to become colonel. If I made it, I would be one of 3 ROTC colonels in Detroit. I sat for the exam again and did the best of all the competitors. I was made city executive officer over all the schools. I had realized my dream. I'd gotten all the way to colonel even though I had joined ROTC late. Several times I thought, "Well, Curtis, you got me started and you made captain. I've passed you, but I wouldn't have gotten into the ROTC if you hadn't done it first." At the end of my 12th grade, I marched at the head of the Memorial Day parade. I felt so proud, my chest bursting with ribbons and braids of every kind. To make it more wonderful, we had important visitors that day. 2 soldiers who had won the Congressional Medal of Honor in Vietnam were present. More exciting to me, General William Westmoreland, very prominent in the Vietnam War, attended with an impressive entourage. Afterward, Sergeant Hunt introduced me to General Westmoreland, and I had dinner with him and the Congressional Medal winners. Later, I was offered a full scholarship to West Point. I didn't refuse the scholarship outright, but I let them know that a military career wasn't where I saw myself going. As overjoyed as I felt to be offered such a scholarship, I wasn't really tempted. The scholarship would have obligated me to spend 4 years in military service after I finished college, precluding my chances to go on to medical school. I knew my direction. I wanted to be a doctor, and nothing would divert me or stand in the way. Of course, the offer of a full scholarship flattered me. I was developing confidence in my abilities, just like my mother had been telling me for at least the past 10 years. Unfortunately, I carried it a little too far. I started to believe that I was one of the most spectacular and smartest people in the world. After all, I had made this unprecedented showing in ROTC, and I stood at the top of my school academically. The big colleges wrote to me and sent out their representatives to recruit me. Meeting representatives from places like Harvard and Yale made me feel special and important because they wanted to recruit me. Few of us get enough experience at feeling special and important, and I was no exception. I didn't know how to handle all the attention. The school reps flocked around me because of my high academic achievements, and because I had done exceptionally well on the Scholastic Aptitude Test, SAT, ranking somewhere in the low 19th percentile. Again, unheard of from a student in the inner city of Detroit. I laugh sometimes when I think of my secret for scoring so high on the SAT. Back when my mother would allow us to watch only 2 or 3 television shows and insisted that we read 2 books a week, I did just that. One program, my favorite, was the General Electric College Bowl. On that program, a quiz show, students from colleges around the country sat as contestants and competed with each other. The master of ceremonies asked factual questions and challenged the knowledge of those students. All week, I looked forward to Sunday nights. In my mind, I had already focused on another secret goal, to be a contestant on the program. To get the chance to appear, I knew I'd have to be knowledgeable in many subjects, so I broadened my range of reading interests. Having inherited a job in the science laboratory after Curtis graduated helped me tremendously because the science teachers saw my desire to know more. They gave me extra tutoring and suggested books or articles for me to read. Although I was doing well in most of the academic subjects, I realized I didn't know a lot about the arts. I started going downtown after school to the Detroit Institute of the Arts. I walked through the exhibit rooms until I knew all the paintings in the main galleries. I checked out library books about various artists and was really taking in all of that material. Before long, I could recognize the master's paintings, name the works themselves, cite the artists' names and their styles. I learned all kinds of information, such as when the artists lived and where they received their training. I soon could recognize the paintings or artists like a flash when questions came up about them on College Bowl. Next, I had to learn about classical music if I wanted to compete. When I started that phase, I used to receive weird looks from people. For instance, I'd be out on the lawn digging up weeds or trimming the grass and have my portable radio playing classical music. That was considered strange behavior for a black kid in Motown. Everybody else was listening to jam and bebop. In truth, I didn't much like the classical music, but here again, Curtis played a decisive role in my life. By then, he was in the Navy, and once when he came home on leave, he brought a couple of records. One of them was Schubert's 8th Symphony, unfinished. He played that record endlessly. "Curtis," I asked, "why do you listen to that stuff? It sounds absolutely ridiculous." "I like it," he said. He might have tried to explain a little about the music, but at the time I wasn't quite ready to hear him. However, he played that record so often during his 2 weeks at home that I found myself going around humming the melody. About that time, I realized that I had actually begun to enjoy classical music. Classical music wasn't totally foreign to me. I had taken clarinet lessons since the 7th grade because that's what my brother played. And after all, that meant my mother had to rent only one instrument in the beginning, and I could use Curtis's old music. Later, I went on to cornet until, in 9th grade, I switched to the baritone. Curtis helped me to enjoy Schubert, and then I bought a record as a gift for my mother. Truthfully, I bought it for myself. The record contained the many overtures from Rossini's operas, including the most well-known, the William Tell Overture. My next step was listening to the German and the Italian arias. I read books about operas and understood the stories. By then I was saying, "This is great music." I no longer pushed myself to learn about classical music because I wanted to be on College Bowl. I'd gotten hooked. By the time I got to college, I could listen to just about any piece of music, from classical to pop, and I'd know who wrote it. I have a good ear for recognizing styles in music, and I cultivated that. During college, every evening I used to listen to a program called The Top 100. It played only classical music. I listened every night, and it wasn't long before I knew the top 100 cold. Then I decided to branch out from just classical music, so I made it a point to listen and learn from a wider range of music. I did everything I knew to get ready to try out for the College Bowl. Unfortunately, I never did get to appear on the program. Chapter 8. College Choices. I stared at the $10 bill on the table before me, knowing I had to make a choice. And since I only had one chance, I wanted to make sure I made the right one. For days, I'd considered the matter from every possible angle. I'd prayed for God to help me, but it still seemed to come down to making one single decision. An ironic situation faced me in the fall of 1968, for most of the top colleges in the country had contacted me